so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to take a look at your pet's health with our guest, Dr. Bill Storick, back with us today. He is the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He's authored several books, does a lot of media work, and we'll hear Dr. Storick's advice on how to get your dog to stop barking constantly. We'll also take a look at tick prevention as that season is well underway, and we'll talk about what you need to know to protect your dog from Lyme's disease this spring. Those and other things as well as we talk with Dr. Bill. But I hope you'll join in with your questions. Will your dog not stop barking? How have you tried to help Fido quiet down? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bill Storick, welcome back. Great to have you with us once again.
Well, good morning, Larry. Happy to be here.
You know, it's obviously, it's natural for dogs to bark, but there's such a thing as too much barking, and maybe it's best to first start with why are some reasons why a dog might be barking a lot?
Well, there's a different reason for every dog that barks a lot, and it could be that they are looking for attention more than anything else. And we see a lot of alarm barkers in the practice, and I call these dogs, they bark at oxygen. And that's all, for some of them, it's almost not an exaggeration. And if you wanted to, you could walk away and we could spend the entire hour and a half talking only about dogs that bark excessively. But hopefully I can boil it down to some extent. And I'll answer that question in about three different ways. And I'll probably wander off on even more tangents than that. But first of all, if you don't want your dog to bark at oxygen and everything it sees, then don't bark at your dog. And what that translates to is, what is human nature? What do we do when the dog barks at the UPS man, the person riding the bike past, or the squirrel outside? You know, instinctively, we'll tell them to be quiet and try and get their attention. Sometimes people will even give them treats after they have started to bark. And what I can say is that if they have already started to bark, you lost that round. And in so many cases, that's going to be very, very true. So what you're searching for is, you have to be more observant than your dog is. And by now, you've got a really good idea of what their triggers are, whether it's chipmunks or squirrels or UPS man, Federal Express drivers, whatever the case may be. And you can't manage to issue a command or make a correction if you don't have the dog's attention. And that squirrel and that chippy is always going to trump whatever you have. So what we encourage people to do, even inside, leash your dog up inside the house so that you have their attention. Then you notice what it is that they're about to start barking at first. Then you get them to do something that you want them to do before they have an opportunity to start barking, and you reward them for the silence. You have them sit, you have them stay, whatever it is that you want them to do. It can be very, very simple. But the bottom line is, you have their attention and you're rewarding them for being silent. And so that's a tool that can work well. And you can even translate that. We have a lot of dogs that are dog reactive. So you take them on walks and they see a dog that's three houses away and they start to bark at that dog. Well, you know, they're going to bark at that dog that's three houses away. In which case, when you're four houses away or five houses away, you get the dog to sit. You, once again, you reward the silence. And after so many repetitions, you can also get a real sense of what their buffer zone is. How far away can that dog be and they're still quiet? And you operate outside of that buffer zone. So that's recommendation number one. Yeah.
And you know, there is a normal amount of barking, I guess, that a dog does.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And that's maybe my second recommendation with regard to dogs like this. And especially, I had a client in last week and she had a puppy, 4 months old. She says, my dog barks at everything. And I said, well, or she said, my dog is starting to bark at more and more things. And my recommendation kind of speaks to what Larry's talking about in the sense that a normal amount of barking is not unusual, in which case your reaction will be their reaction. So the calmer you are, the calmer they will be. And if your dog is barking at something that's walking by, go make a meatloaf or check an email and stone cold ignore the dog. And if they don't get any attention out of the situation, there's a really good chance that it will diffuse the behavior. Once that behavior becomes ingrained and once it becomes hardwired, well, then you have to set about the arduous task of teaching an old dog new tricks, which can be done in spite of the old adage. And there's another recommendation that we'll frequently make with regard to dogs that bark at oxygen. And that is that there's tremendous value on the front end for folks to use crates to train their dogs. And so their dog can be comfortable in a crate. If your dog is not comfortable in a crate, then surely you have a laundry room or somewhere else that you can take them. When they start to bark at something that's going on outside, no fanfare, no correction, you're not talking to them at all. You put them on a leash, you walk them to the crate, you shut the door. And some might say, my goodness, I don't want them to perceive that the crate or the room, or the laundry room, bathroom is punishment. We're not throwing them in there. We're not reprimanding them. God forbid, we're not yelling at them. We're just taking them from something that they want to do to something that they don't want to do. And once again, you reward the silence. The quiet dog gets to come out of the crate or the bathroom or the laundry room.
All good tips. you know, they're, from an evolutionary standpoint, I mean, barking is served a purpose for dogs forever.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And, you know, people will ask the very popular question, well, if somebody wants to break into the house, I want my dog to bark at them. And we absolutely do. And you can make that, that's a hard distinction to make. And when people say, but I want them to bark if somebody tries to break into the house, I don't have the perfect answer as far as how they make that distinction.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. And I'm wondering, you know, what effect, what health effect, you know, you get a dog that's barking all the time. You there's got to be some health effect there.
Well, or it is also the representation of a health effect, because anybody who has listened to us on this show before realizes that we talk a lot about stress, and dogs that bark obsessively at everything that happens outside of their house is probably also a dog that's mentally or physically underemployed. And as you know, there's so many dogs that are purpose-driven breeds. Lots of people have heelers and border collies and shelties and labs and retrievers, dogs that are meant to hunt, dogs that are meant to herd, dogs that are meant to have a job. And guess what? Now you're living in a 2,200-foot house or a 1,000-square-foot apartment, and you're underemployed. In which case, and great topic you make, Larry, before you bring that dog home, make some plans as far as where you're going to walk, where you're going to socialize that dog, how you're going to engage that dog, how you're going to keep that dog busy so that you don't let that stress build up that manifests as my dog barks at everything that walks by the house. And of course, delivery people are absolutely perfect because they absolutely reward dogs for barking at them, because they come to the door, they deliver the mail, dog barks at them, and they leave. Wow, I won that round. So that's another one to work on diffusing.
Yeah. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. We starting by talking about getting your dog to stop the excessive barking. And of course, we're taking other health questions as well as we move along today. You can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Jeff Robbins, our technical director today, Clara Neipertz, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back, and certainly you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. And Dr. Bill, I don't know if you've heard about this. Jill Nadeau was telling me about a sort of a piece of cloth, like a hood, that you can put over your dog's head to sort of ease the anxiety and stop their barking. Have you heard of that or any similar kind of tool?
Oh, sure. There's a variety of tools like that. Falls under the category of like the thunder vests and things like that. And those things can work well for some dogs and not so well for other dogs, but absolutely great tools.
You know, and here we've been talking a lot about dogs. What about cats? What if your cat is being very vocal?
Well, if your cat is being very vocal, the first thing that I would do is look for underlying medical issues. And we start breaking that down by age and by environment and appetite. And we go by system. Are they eating? Are they drinking well? Are they toileting well? Straining in the litter box, whether to make urine or to make stool. Are they maintaining their weight? Is their mobility excellent? Are they still able to get up and down the stairs and on and off their furniture and things like that? So we go by system-wise to make sure that there's no underlying medical issues that could result in the excess vocalization.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Jolie in Wausau has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jolie.
Hello. My dog got last year blastomycetosis, and we got her on medicine that was called
itraconazole.
Itraconazole. So we got, that's the one. So we had it on. We've been having it since August that she's been on this medicine. Well, I worry about, will she get it again, or how susceptible is she to get it again? And right now I'm currently on it, but I'm doing every other day taking the chewable pill that she is taking. Is that okay to do it every other day and continue it through the summer?
Well, I will answer that by saying that whatever your veterinarian in Wausau is recommending for the treatment, that's exactly what I would stick with. And if you have been treating your dog, Jolie, since August, then that must have been one heck of a case of blastomycosis. And if your dog is still doing great, that's awesome because blastomycosis is a beast and it can be really difficult to get under control. And the answer to the question, what are the chances that it will get it again? Exactly the same as the chances that it got it the first time. And for those not acquainted, blasto is a fun word to say, but it's a nasty organism. And where it lives is in marshy soil, wet areas, rotting wood, and it exists in spore form. And so it enters the body by way of the respiratory tract, and the spores will set up shop in the lungs, and they can sit there dormant for days, weeks, or months before they start to disseminate throughout the body. And when they do, they can show up anywhere from the prostate to the eyeballs and anywhere in between. It's a nasty one.
Hmm. Jolie, there you go. Maybe check back in with your vet and see what your vet says about it. Thank you very much for calling. Tolie in Hoka, thank you for calling.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I have a little 11-pound teddy bear pup, and she's got allergies. And the stuff, the chewables from the vet don't seem to work that good, and I gave her some Claritin D, just a little, very little bit of it, and it seemed to be a lot better for her, and I was wondering what you thought about using that for, like, full-time with her.
Well, what I think is that allergies are a process, and the first words out of my mouth when I see patients with allergies are that there's something that ends up being more managed than absolutely cured, and every dog responds differently. At 11 pounds, how old is your little teddy bear pup?
She's going to be 8 years old. She's my 911 girl on September 11th.
Gotcha. Okay. So, you know, if the Claritin is helping keep the symptoms under control, what I say, people will say, well, my dog was itching, my dog was sneezing, so I gave it some antihistamines. My response is, okay, we know that it's going to itch during this time of year, and we know it's going to sneeze during this time of the year. Give it the antihistamines to prevent it from getting out of control. And what I would encourage you to do is, if a treatment, and I don't know what the chewables that your veterinarian sent home were, I think it might have been Apoquel, because Apoquel now comes in a chewable form. If that's not working, then let your veterinarian know, because that's a drug that the frequency and the dosage has a bit of range to it. So he may be looking to adjust the dose or the frequency.
Yeah. All right. There you go, Tolie. Thank you for calling. Bob in Sun Prairie, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry. I just got an interesting little story about, 50 years ago. Now, people don't do this much anymore, but back in the day, I was a paper boy, and I had a lot of trouble with dogs because people would discipline their dogs with a rolled up newspaper. Yeah.
Oh, how times have changed, Bob.
And so I would show up at the door, of course, with the newspaper and got in trouble with the dog. So I just thought it was kind of a humorous little story, but it was quite true.
Bob, thanks for that. You know, dogs learn pretty fast.
Yes. Well, they make associations, and they absolutely do. And so frequently we will hear things like, well, I think my dog was abused by a man. And I don't think there are guys that go around abusing puppies very often, or at least I hope that's not the case. But they make associations. They make them quickly, and they can make them remotely as well.
I was thinking about a dog that I dog sit for, Lila, and when I'm out with a long walk with her and it happens to be mail delivery time, regardless of the mail carrier, she gets really excited and wants to go right over to that mail carrier, because the one that stops at her house all the time gives her a treat.
One of our Federal Express drivers in this neighborhood gets out and plays with the dogs and feeds them treats. And his biggest problem is the dogs jump in the truck with him.
So it didn't make any difference to Lila if it was a guy, a gal, or whoever it was. The uniform was what she was responding to. So she learned that in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Bob, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Rick in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I have a behavioral mystery. I hope it's lighthearted and not indicative of something really bad, but my approximately six-year-old Steffi. In the backyard, there's an area of just, to my eye, just dirt by a hydrangea bush that he will lick. I'd say most times he goes out in the yard, not every time, and I can get him away from it, but he'll just lick and lick and lick this dirt. It's a couple of specific spots in about a 2 square foot area. And he just, I can't see anything, any food or anything that's otherwise of interest to a dog, but it must be some minerals or something valuable to him, because he'll just lick that dirt until I stop him. Have you ever heard of such a thing or have any theories as to what he's after there?
Yes, we have heard of such a things. Absolutely. The hydrangea bush, we're going to call that an incidental finding. And I assume, because you don't mention that, he doesn't lick, the furniture, the carpet, the floors, any other things aside from that precious piece of dirt next to the hydrangea bush.
That right, Rick?
Yes. He's okay. Not an obsessive licker otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay. A place to start over the counter would be with Prilosec, Omeprazole, because sometimes sometimes excessive licking can be associated with gastric reflux, like heartburn.
Oh.
So, yeah, I assume you don't feed him excessive Mexican food or anything, spicy food or anything like that, do you, Rick?
No, not really, not at all, really. Pretty straightforward diet. Egg, burger, yeah, and kibble and, you know, treats. But no, I stay away from anything that I, you know, spicy.
Yeah, no.
But it can be associated with gastric reflux and you can give him Omeprazole is over the counter and exceedingly safe. And you can see if that curbs the behavior just a little bit.
Yeah, worth a try. Rick, give it a shot. Mary in Delavan, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a two-year-old rescue. I've had her just about 2 years. She's 2.5 years old. And what she will do on occasion is lift a paw and start screaming, where I have to go up and hug her to get her to stop. And then she'll trot. I'll offer a treat or something. She'll trot down the stairs. Like, there's really nothing wrong with her. Then next time it might be a different paw, like the other paw. So it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with her, but the scream is just like she's really hurt. And I know when she had a broken toenail, like one had bent backwards or something, I would, you know, rub the paw and make her feel better. And maybe she associated that with lifting this paw, but she doesn't seem to have any health issues. But this screaming is kind of, you know, frightening sometimes.
Yeah,
it's loud.
I would think so. Okay.
Oh, I would think so. Marion Delavan, is this back paws or front paws?
It's front paws.
Okay. And after she has vocalized in that fashion, and she has held that paw up, does she limp on that paw or head bob at all after that?
No, nothing.
And how often does this take place? Does this take place every day, twice a week?
No. It's kind of random. I mean, I tried, if I see it coming, you know, I see her lifting a paw, I kind of just walk away from her and tell her, no, I'm not for it. Yeah. It's not that regular, but it happens on occasion.
Okay. And I assume no other health issues, like you don't find her hesitant to go up and down the stairs, or you don't find her disoriented, head tilt, circling, anything to that effect?
No, because I have a flight of stairs to get into my house, and she trots up and down those.
Okay, perfect. Well, because front legs can be discomfort, can be as a result of front leg discomfort, can also be as a result of neck pain, and neck pain can be as a result of neuropathies. So what I encourage folks to do, if we've got a symptom that we can't entirely explain, then we take a couple of steps back and look at the whole machine, eating well, drinking well, moving well, and oriented, then we can give this a little time to declare itself. Because if you take this dog to your veterinarian, he's going to be wringing his hands, because of course the dog will be perfectly normal during the visit. A thing that could help is if you have a sense that it's coming along and you're quick with your cell phone, get a video of it and show that to your veterinarian, because that could be the best clue of all.
Yeah, that's a good idea. If you got your phone handy, that would be an excellent way to do it. Mary, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, yeah, Nancy and Nina emailed us. They recently had to have their 15-year-old cat euthanized. Sorry. Nancy's other cat, who's been a companion with that cat for the past 8 years, seems stressed and is acting differently. Nancy's wondering what to do to maybe alleviate the stress of the cat.
And I assume the other cat is also pretty aged as well, if they've been together for extensive periods
for eight
of time.
Years, yeah.
Yeah, for 8 years. Well, you know, I don't have any sophisticated medical advice for this aside from whatever is special to the cat left behind. Do it for them, whether that is a favorite type of canned food or tuna or toys or engagement of any sort. Because, you know, people ask us all the time, do you think cats and dogs can mourn? And I don't really give a flip what the science is behind it. I've seen it in my own pets, and it can last a long time, and it can be deep-seated, and it's really depressing to watch it happen. So my less than substantial answer is whatever is special to that cat, do it every day.
Yeah, I like that idea. Jay and Washburn, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a German Shepherd Husky mix, and he quite frequently gets really bad irritation in between the pads of his paws. And we think it's pododermatitis. Our local vet was able to get a look, but not a close look recently, because he really hates his paws being touched. And we're going to get him in later, where he's going to be under for some dental surgery, and they can take a better look then and maybe get a swab. But I'm just wondering if there's a practice or some treatment that we can do until that point to treat this. His paws get really red and inflamed, and to the point of cracking and bleeding, and he licks them a lot.
Hmm. Okay, Jay and Washburn. Hopefully I get up your way this summer to go to Big Top. Just love that place up there. So I assume we're talking all four paws, correct?
Well, it's usually just one front and one back. It's not all of them. Yeah.
And are we talking pads or are we talking in between the pads?
In between the pads, kind of deep in between.
And how does he feel about Jay handling his paws as compared to the veterinarians handling his paws?
A little better. I can usually work with it and take a look. And we've used some antiseptic wipes in him, but he doesn't care for that either.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I ask, because the best idea in the world isn't worth a hoot if the dog won't tolerate it. And so some of the things that can be effective if he will tolerate it is like a dilute chlorhexidine or a dilute betadine solution, but that's only valuable if he will really let you immerse the paw in those solutions, because those areas are really tough to be able to access, especially in a dog like that, because it's really hairy and it's really involved down there. And if indeed these dogs won't let you handle the area between their paws that way, I put them on oral medication and like antibiotics and antifungals. And when he goes in for his dental and he's under anesthesia, they'll be able to really get a good look in there. Maybe they might even culture it. But in the meantime, you might want to ask if there's anything orally that could help him out.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Jay, thank you. Good luck. And thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. What's going on with your pet's health? The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Carol emailed us. She's a proud grandma to a 21-week-old puppy. The puppy chews on people, walking, sitting. She's good when she's tired. Owners do not distract her or anything because she is a puppy. Carol says this drives her crazy. And I remember Patricia McConnell often talking about those kinds of young dogs as a mouth with paws.
Oh, we love Patricia McConnell. So, first of all, I bet you have uttered the phrase, "Oh my gosh, I forgot what it's like to have a puppy," about 300 times in your course of taking care of this puppy. And the popular recommendation for these guys, especially when they go into piranha mode, is to distract them, to give them something that is appropriate for them to chew on. And I can say from experience, that's just a wonderful idea that doesn't often work very well, because those dogs have a tendency to be in high drive. And I'm going to circle back to a recommendation that we made earlier in the program. And that is, when they're chomping on things, one of two approaches. If it's hands that they're chewing on, if it is anything that can be removed, remove it. Don't extend your hands to them. Of course, your feet are on the floor, so they're always going to have access to your feet. But what I do with those dogs is put them in the crate and shut the gate. And it's just a little bit like a kid that's a little bit overstimulated, in which case you give them a timeout. And the calm dog gets to come out. Then another way to look at this situation is, we budget the phrase, "Oh, he'll grow out of it," really, really carefully. We almost never use it, because when people hear that, they could get the impression that they don't have to do anything and the dog will just pass through this phase. But once upon a time, I had a 20-week-old Australian Shepherd Blue Heeler cross that I wanted to drive back to Wyoming, where that dog came from, in the worst way. But that dog was attached to this really wonderful red-headed woman. And I, It was either both or none. So we got through it, but only by actively giving them a timeout and some patience, of course.
Jerry in Kokana has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. Question is, what about the Lyme vaccine? I've heard good and bad. I know that at least what I've heard is that it's bacterial, so it's not effective for a long duration, like 3 to 6 months only. And the humans had a Lyme vaccine, but that was quickly taken off the market because of all the problems. Can you speak about the Lyme vaccine for dogs?
You bet. Lyme vaccine, especially for dogs that live the Lyme life, as in exposed to ticks, as in live within the boundaries of the state of Wisconsin, then we recommend the Lyme vaccine. And it is an excellent component to tick prevention and Lyme prevention. And there's a bit of history involved with the negative that you heard about the vaccine. There was a time when it first came out that the Lyme vaccine was almost as rugged as the Lyme disease. The vaccine has become much more targeted, much more specific, many fewer side effects, and it is protective for a year. Once it is boosted, and you're exactly correct. It's a Bacterin. We're vaccinating against a bacteria, so the protection is not as long as it is against the viruses, but it's good protection because a statistic that has held up for a very long time is that half of the ticks in the Midwest are deer ticks and half of the deer ticks are Lyme positive. So 25% of the ticks out there are Lyme positive. And we also recommend a form of protection, whether it be topicals, whether it be orals, and especially for those dogs that spend any kind of time outdoors. And ticks are unbelievably adaptive to finding a blood meal.
Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. Our guest today, Dr. Bill Stork, owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinics. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on WPR. Larry Mueller here as we talk your pet's health with our guest, Dr. Bill Stork, owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. It's great to have Dr. Bill stop by, and he does a great job. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We had a comment from a listener emailed about tear stains. They're wondering, how do they get rid of tear stains on their Bichon Frise?
The best suggestion that I have heard with regard to tear stains, there's two different approaches. There are certain probiotics that can be added to the food that label claim is that they will help diminish tear stain. The other thing that can help is, and first of all, it's likely going to be a lifelong condition, is that in the excess tear film that runs down the face of these white dogs, there's a little bit of an infection. And I don't want to say that your dog has an eye infection. That's not a problem. That there's a population of bacteria that can live in the tear stain that runs down their face that results in the color change on their white fur that you see. Sometimes antibiotics given to the eye itself can reduce that. But in all likelihood, when you remove the antibiotics, the condition will come back. It has a tendency to persist. And there have been, as I say, people who feel that probiotics in their food over a long period of time, as you can imagine, it takes a long time for these things to resolve, can make a difference.
Susan in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan up next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. The fellow that called whose dog was licking the dirt around the hydrangea, I'm just wondering if the dirt has all kinds of yummy stuff in there, composting. I had a dog that just loved my topsoil pile and just seemed like he was going for particular things in there. So that's what I was just wondering. That's what I had heard. There's all kinds of yummy things going on.
Yeah. Could be, Dr. Bill.
Well, it absolutely could be. Our dogs love our topsoil because we also have horses. And when we plant gardens, we use our homegrown fertilizer and horse manure that we make cultured soil out of. And absolutely, the dogs love that.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks. Thanks, Susan. Appreciate it. Gianna in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Gianna.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a four-year-old German Shepherd mix. She is a rescue. I've had her for about 2.5 years. And she's had some anxiety issues, is currently unreconciled for that. But one of the behavior problems that I'm not quite sure how to address is guarding of toys. She doesn't guard her food. She doesn't guard me. She's, she's pretty timid. But if we're at the dog park, or even if a dog is playing with her in my home, she will guard a bone, like a chew, Nyla bone kind of toy, or a ball at the dog park. Not your average tennis ball, but if she decides she really likes one ball more than the other balls, she will pin another dog down, bare her teeth. I mean, she's very loud, and it's very startling to other dog owners who, you know, don't enjoy that behavior. And I can't figure out how to get her to stop doing it.
Well, you want, I'll answer that in a few ways. And first of all, it's awesome that she communicates with you so clearly. And you're not likely to get her to not resource guard those things. And the fact that she's resource guarding those things is a really excellent indicator. So first of all, if she resource guards bones or balls and things that you can predict, they have to be removed from the environment, because otherwise she's going to guard them. Then there are some specific exercises that you can use with other things that could diminish the resource guarding. And an exercise that we'll have people do with their dogs in order to diminish the likelihood that they will resource guard is, for example, when she eats, you present her with a bowl that is empty. And it's empty because you have the food in another bowl or a cup or whatever you want. And then you call her over, you have her sit. And I know you said that she doesn't resource guard her food, but it's the same behavior that we're addressing from a different angle. And then you get her to do something you want her to do. Could be so simple as just sit, shake with the other paw, and you meter the food out so that she realizes that she has to do what you ask of her in order for her to get that food. And as I'll circle back and I'll say it again, what you're describing is some pretty high order resource guarding, in which case, whatever it is that she guards, you have to take it away before she has an opportunity to possess it.
Gianna, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Mary in West Bend next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. A few minutes ago, your guest talked about ticks, and 25% of the ticks out there are carrying Lyme disease, was what he said.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what out there is to him.
Oh, so anywhere outside of your door, first of all, but as I say, ticks are really amazing opportunists, and they are attracted to heat, motion, carbon monoxide. And in which case, let's say, for example, you probably have like a restored prairie near your house or a sidewalk near your house, and ticks will gather in an increased density on the margins of those walking areas. Or God forbid, like by us, we have all kinds of restored prairies. And if you look, there's animal paths through between the person walking paths. Ticks know to hang on the margins of those areas on the blades of grass. And when they sense heat, carbon monoxide, when they sense a blood meal coming, they will flag and they will attach to them. God forbid, if you ever break down next to the highway by the interstate, heat, carbon monoxide, the ditches and medians along the road are incredibly dense with ticks. And like in Larry's neighborhood, I have a good friend that lives a couple blocks away from Larry, and it's way more popular to grow wildflower gardens than it is to mow your grass. And when you're walking down the sidewalks near his house, ticks are just going to love all of those wildflowers that are about to start going crazy in the grasses and stuff like that.
So there you go. And again, for prevention, or what can we, you know, I think it bears repeating of what is the best thing we can do. One thing is, I suppose, check our pets for ticks.
Yeah, you can check your pets, but
it's hard.
Oh, it truly is. And, you know, if you've got a Vizsla, it's one thing. If you have a Great Pyrenees, it's an entirely another order of business, not to mention the fact, as I said, Lyme disease is incredibly prevalent. And the things that can be effective are, you know, forever and ever, we've had Frontline. Frontline is a good product. I will never disparage Frontline, but it's been around for quite a while. And when we have breaks in protection, it's oftentimes dogs that have been on Frontline. There are other topical products that will repel, and those will do a good job. Most people have preferred over the past several years to use oral preventives, and there's a number of them out there. Your veterinarian is going to have recommendations along those lines. And for those who will say things like, I don't want to put those chemicals in my dog's body, I respect that mentality to the end of the line. However, the risk that those products prevent is much less than, dramatically less than Lyme disease. Because when Lyme disease goes well in dogs, when Lyme disease goes well, it can cause anemia, platelet deficiency, lameness, fever, and lethargy. When Lyme disease goes poorly, and about 10% of dogs that develop Lyme disease develop Lyme nephritis, kidney disease, as a result of Lyme disease. In 32 years, I've saved one of those dogs. And one of those dogs that I didn't manage to save belonged to someone who was absolutely near and dear to me. It was a 6-year-old Labrador Retriever. And that is positively heartbreaking. And if you Google Brevecto, if you Google Simparica, you're going to, the big wide internet is going to say things like, those products caused seizures, those products caused cancer. Not the case. Association does not mean causation. And I beg you to dig deeply inside of the numbers and the research. And as I say, Everybody has to make their own choices. Lifestyle has a great deal to do with it. If you have a Yorkie that just runs outside, goes to the bathroom on a patch of grass and runs back inside, their exposure is going to be much less than a dog that pheasant hunts. But that dog that I just described, I've found those dogs to be Lyme positive as well.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Bill Storick, our guest today, the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. And you know what? He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your questions as we look at your pet's health. You can join in. You can email us to ideas@WPR.org or give a call, 800-642-1234. And we'll be back with Dr. Bill right after we take a quick look at the news, and we'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the program with our guest, Dr. Bill Storick, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back with us. And lots of callers. We get lots of emails. Ellen in Neosho has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Larry. Greetings to you and Dr. Bill. I have two questions. First of all, I would like Dr. Bill's opinion on Seresto collars. And the second question is there a Lyme disease or a tick preventive that I can use with my horse? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you again.
Mm-hmm. So with regard to Seresto collars, as collars go, they're as good as they can get. And they can be popular for a number of reasons. Like, for example, if there are young kids involved and around the dogs, then the collar is something that you can put on when the dog is going to go out in more densely populated tick areas, and then you can take it off, put it in a plastic bag. It's popular in that sense. It's also excellent because the majority of ticks that we find are around the head and neck and the mouth and the ears. Good if I had a dog that was going to be frequently exposed to highly dense areas, it wouldn't be my favorite choice. And with regard to your horse, you bet. Anything that repels biting flies, horse flies, gnats and things like that will also repel ticks. In the barn, my wife got on to using once upon a time Listerine, and you can buy big old bottles of Listerine and you can spray it on your horse and it does a decent job of repelling flies and mosquitoes and gnats. If I were going trail riding, in the Driftless area, I would not use that as my choice. I would use fly spray for it. But it's a good preventive when you're not exactly exposed.
Ellen, thanks again. Pat in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, my name is Pat Grosh. I have two French bulldogs. And when there are people over to our house and there's conversation and talking, the one bulldog will go over and actually just bite one of the people. And it's very annoying because I can't stop him. I don't know how to train him not to bite people. Altogether, he's bit probably 5 different people. Also, he's bit my grandson, who was playing with him. So I need your suggestions.
Now, when you're mentioning bite, is this a nip or is it a bite? I don't know if that makes a difference, but I'm just wondering.
It absolutely does.
I would say it's more of a nip. He'll open his mouth and he'll go over and bite. But there is a little bit of intensity to it because it hurts.
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough question in a tough situation. And Larry's question is absolutely founded because not all bites are created equally. But a thing that I can say is when there are kids who are being bitten, that dog doesn't get to be in that situation. And when a dog has bitten five people in your home, that dog doesn't get to be in that situation. And the intricacies of how to diffuse that behavior are there's just too many variables for me to answer that question on the radio. That would be a question to be answered by a professional behaviorist in your area that works with reward-based training. But the short answer is they don't get to be in the room.
Yeah, they need to be probably in one of their cages or put somewhere out of reach of the people.
Yeah, and the likelihood, and this is a discussion that we've had a number of times, and keep in mind, it's difficult to answer this because I don't know the dog, I don't know the specifics of the situation, but the likelihood that that dog will be able to be bomb-proof and reliable, you can't.
No, it's... It'd be worth it to get a certified applied animal behaviorist to come to your home, yeah, or go to that person and let somebody with that kind of skill and training probably tell you the same thing that Bill's going to tell you.
Yeah, and the people come first, bottom line.
Yeah. Bonnie in Shorewood, we go to you. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello. I have a 6-year-old standard poodle rescue. She is almost perfect. Hello?
Yes.
We're waiting for the but.
Well, yes, but when we pull into the parking lot of the dog park, she goes ballistic. She is so excited. She just cannot control her bark in ear. And I have tried, when I approach the parking lot, shoving treats at her like a Pez dispenser. And she will grab the treat and literally choke trying to bark at the same time. So.
And I assume this is an excited bark because she's so glad to be there.
Absolutely. She cannot wait to get out and run with the pack.
Yeah.
All right. Well, first of all, that's great. And I love the fact that you've got a 6-year-old poodle that's a rescue and that is the biggest knock on her system. And I guess I'm going to fall back on an earlier philosophy that we talked about, which is knowing their buffer zones. And if she starts to get excited and bark when you go to the dog park, when you pull into the parking lot, wherever the last point is that she doesn't get excited and start barking, park your car and walk her.
There you go.
And you know, if she is an 80-pound standard poodle, that could get interesting all by itself. But that, and she's probably also going to get excited when she's walking to the parking lot, but that's my...
She won't be doing it right in your ear, buddy.
Yeah, at least she won't be doing it in your ear and blowing treats all over your car.
Oh, man. Thank you for calling. Jackie in Meadow Village. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about two of my 6 cats. The two of them are extremely fat. One is 13 years old, and she's 22 pounds. The other one is not even a year, and she's 13 pounds. My other cats are of, like, average weight. They, you know, they don't seem to be overweight at all. I've tried weight control, and she... The younger one, she just lays right there and just will eat and eat and doesn't really like the other cats to eat. She will let them eat, but she prefers to lay right by the bowl and watch them eat. So is there a certain breed? They're not, these cats are not related, but is there a certain breed that is fat?
Boy, Jackie, I almost wish I had an emergency walk into my clinic right now so I could run away from this question. I honestly think that we will have subdivisions on Mars before we absolutely solve the problem that you just presented, because you presented two challenges on top of one another, one of which is big cats. And we have this legendary cat in our clinic named Bob years ago. Bob weighed 32 pounds. He belonged to two engineers. And if you know engineers, they're very precise people. And we told them how many calories that cat should eat. And I'm pretty sure they had a microtome and a bomb calorimeter. And that's exactly what they fed that cat. And Bob went from 32 pounds to 28.5 pounds. And from that point forward, I think he resorted to photosynthesis because we were barely feeding that cat and he would not lose weight. Then you have the additional challenge of having multiple cats in the household, because I assume the rest of your four cats are weight appropriate. So it's really hard to feed cats individually. And for a while we had a weight loss drug on the market that I'm pretty sure isn't out there anymore. There are some hardcore foods. There's a food called satiety support that will, that comes as close as anything to being a diet food. It's only about 200 calories per cup. Most cat food is around 400 calories per cup, and or the biggest tool that most will recommend for taking weight off your cat, believe it or not, is canned food. And a lot of people are under the impression that canned food is very rich in calories. Canned food, strangely, is not very calorically dense and very high in moisture. And so for these big cats, canned food is our friend, and you add more water to it.
Hmm. Yeah, good tip. Jackie, good luck. Appreciate your call. Peter in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you for taking this. I laughed at the perfect rescue there. I have a rescue that's 8 months along here. I think I'm the fourth owner. And this dog, again, is perfect, but he leaks. And just like a puppy, if he's on his tummy getting a tummy rub, he will just a tiny little dribble. Every once in a while, there'll be a little leaky, and I'll notice on the carpet a couple spots. I have to dab them up. Probably two nights a week, he sleeps on fleece. Probably two nights a week, he wakes up and the fleece is pretty wet. And I don't give him much water at night, but I don't think that's the problem. I think he just leaks. And so I'm wondering, what will I run into when I take him to the vet to have this problem dealt with?
Probably the first thing they'll do is ask for a good, cleanly caught urine sample so that they can rule out urinary tract infections. This does not present exactly like a urinary tract infection, but that's what we would hope it would be, because that's something that we can directly affect. There are things that are so simple as just urinary incontinence, and those conditions we can treat fairly handily. They're not, incontinence is not common in younger, I think you refer to him as a he in a male dog. There are some anatomic issues that could result in the behavior that you're describing, one of which is called an ectopic ureter, which is a condition that's a little bit difficult to specifically diagnose, but we can get suspicious of it by exclusion, by ruling things out. So your veterinarian will almost assuredly ask for a urine sample that he'll do cultures on, and maybe even take radiographs. But we hopefully can help.
All right, Peter, good luck. Thank you so much. Elsie in Wauwatosa, looking for clarification on your recommendations for the German Shepherd guarding toys at the dog park. Is it a good idea to take a dog to a park who might be struggling with aggressive behavior?
Well, that's a really most excellent point, and I considered that with my answer, but it also sounded as if it really was directed towards resources, balls and bones and things like that. And if that's not the case, and there are other aggressive behaviors, because that sounded like a lot of dog physically. And if there are other aggressions outside of the resource guarding, perfect point. Yeah. Then we're not ready for the dog park yet.
Amy in Mequon, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, very good. First of all, I just want to say I love the show, and I'm not looking forward to the end of May where we're not going to be hearing you all in Milwaukee. So I resist that. So I just want you to know that, Larry. We will not tolerate that. Moving on, though, my question is, I've resisted using systemic flea, heartworm, tick medicines for many, many years. Now my dog is on Simparica. She has lots of she's a border collie. We give her lots of opportunity to be out in the woods and in the yard, and there's plenty of ticks. My question is that with the Simparica, what happens to the fleas and ticks? So they jump on the dog. Do they jump off like a flea collar, or do they have to bite the dog? And then do they die and then drop off the dog, or do they jump onto me? Or what's going on with the creatures after they, and how do they get in touch with the Simparica? Is it blood or is it surface?
No, beautiful question. And the answer to it is when those environments set up shop and start to take a blood meal, then once they start to take a blood meal, they die. And they're actually neurotoxins that are specific to the insects that are attempting to take a blood meal from your dog. And when they fall off as a result of the medication, they are graveyard dead. Before they start to take a blood meal, like if your dog is just the vehicle that the fleas or the ticks use to get a ride into your house, then yeah, and they can be transported into your house. And there's not very many products that are really good at repelling, with the exception of, there's a product called Vectra, and Vectra is a topical spot-on product. The way it kills fleas and ticks is still when they establish and start to take a blood meal. But Vectra, and someone asked about the Seresto collar, those two things can achieve a bit of repellency as well.
All right. Amy, thank you so much for being with us and for calling in. Annette called. She has a kitty with a very tender mouth, and the kitten may have to get some teeth removed. How dangerous is this surgery?
Well, if you're talking about a kitten with a sore mouth, I'm going to make a translation and an assumption that that is a condition called stomatitis. And stomatitis is one of the most heart-wrenching conditions that we see in veterinary medicine. And when you open that cat's mouth, maybe they're hypersalivating, maybe they have a really intense red line where their gum meets the tooth. And the dentistry itself is as safe as anesthesia can be. And most of us do pre-anesthetic blood work. These cats are intubated during the procedure. They're on gas anesthesia. They have technicians that are monitoring EKG, intravenous catheters. They're very well supported. You know, most of our patients are better supported under anesthesia than when I had my knee replaced. The real danger is if those diseased teeth remain in your cat's mouth, because they're painful.
So they need to be gone. Yeah. Lynn,
yes.
Yeah. Lynn and Stoddard, do you have a quick question?
Yes. I live on a farm. I have a friend who has an adult male neutered cat with claws still intact. I am needing a farm cat. I currently do have a female neutered adult cat on my farm. So, two questions. Is it a good or possible idea or a bad idea to have a cat that has lived its whole life indoors, now turned into a barn cat, not doing it until the weather is clearly going to be warm? And the other one is introducing it to this other cat that we have here already.
Well, we have a saying, and we have to keep an eye on the clock here. We have a saying that dogs are territorial, but cats wrote the book. And it's a little bit more open-ended when you introduce a cat to the outdoors, because they have lots more options as far as resources and places to sleep, eat, drink, toilet, things like that. But man, it is quite the risk to move a cat that spent its entire life inside to being outside, because those cats know nothing about avoiding being prey and being resourceful. I mean, it could work out, but it's a big risk to move a cat from inside to become an outside cat.
Yeah. Lynn, there you go. Thank you for that question. And Dr. Bill Stork, thank you so much for being with us once again. I hope you'll do it again with us.
Well, sure. gives me an hour and a half off, that so I'm grateful for it.
Dr. Bill Stork, owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He'll be back and he'll be with us once again. Always great to have him with us, and great to have you listening in. Tomorrow, we'll talk about efforts to protect large birds like owls, hawks, and loons, and we'll talk about raising backyard chickens as well. Stay with us. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.